Welcome, all of you wine and true crime lovers. I'm Brandy.
And I'm Chris.
And this is Texas Wine and True Crime. Thank you for being here, friends, for this week's episode, part two of the Fort Worth Missing Trio. Chris, we are back for part two of this unsolved case in Fort Worth of three missing girls. So we will wrap up with suspects, theories, and whether or not we think this case will ever be solved. Had some great wine and food in part one. So please, friends, go back and check out part one as we roll into part two. We do have a new Patreon member to welcome. So thank you, Karen Ginn.
Yes, thank you, Karen.
And welcome to our Patreon family. Chris, since we were on a podcast project offsite the first week of August, I know you're going to put up a one or two extra little recipes for our patrons this month. This is a long month. We still have another week and then another almost full week in August. I feel like September is just around the corner. So be looking for those and that bonus episode coming out towards the end of the month. All right, Chris, let's jump into part two of the Fort Worth Missing Trio.
Okay, let's jump in.
Chris, we left off talking about this letter that seems to be a bit of a red herring in this case. I feel like this letter is presented to buy time or just to completely throw off the investigation. Now, even though I believe the details might be a little bit of a red herring, this is the only solid piece of evidence in this case besides the car.
Yeah, it seemed like one of the only pieces of evidence, really.
Yeah, so they've looked at this several times. I did get a couple of messages asking, have the police looked at writing samples from Rachel compared to this? And yes, they have. And then I learned that the FBI has come back every time and said inconclusive. Now, I also now understand what that means. It doesn't necessarily mean that they believe she wrote it or she didn't write it. They're saying that it's close enough they can't say yes or no. So they have to call it inconclusive because they just can't determine whether or not she actually wrote it. So that's sort of the conundrum here and why.
They just don't have any other documents that she's ever written to be able to compare to? Is this what's...
Well, there's been a couple... Inconclusive? Yes. So they did have her writing samples, which they did compare. Some of it looked familiar, but people who don't believe Rachel wrote this letter believe it had to be written by someone that either knew her personally, knew how she wrote. So then what are we looking at? Are we looking at someone possibly close to her that wrote this? So they're torn either way at this point. This case is almost a half a century old. We mentioned that in part one. Most of the girls' parents are deceased. There are a few still living, but there are family members that are still alive and are keeping, you know, this case active and giving it some hope. But when you have a case like this with little to no direct evidence to tie any really direct suspects to this case, along the years, there's so many years that go by, right? So there's rumors, right? There's family members that point fingers. There's these phone calls that are happening. There's the letter. There's this rumor of a possible love triangle, right, that we're going to get into. Mm-hmm. There's also these sightings of Rachel around Christmas time in the years following the disappearance. These are a little strange.
Sightings where?
Multiple places, but that one of the private investigators and then Rusty, who I'm going to talk about in a second, which was Rachel's younger brother at the time. He was 11 when she disappeared. So he is really the one, Chris, that has moved this case along even today, right? So he is... kept it alive, kept it active. But him and another PI have looked into these Rachel sightings. They do say some of these could be credible witnesses. But again, just there's nothing, right? There's really no actual physical sign of her. They haven't seen her themselves.
That doesn't make much sense, though. Like, she's going to get a new Social Security number and identification.
Something along the lines of, like, she's being held and... kept away from family purposely. Again,
you
seems very far-fetched. Yeah, this is early on after they disappeared. This isn't like 30 years later. This is just a few of the years following their disappearance.
Yeah, but I still think there's three people involved, not just one. It's different to hold that many people hostage for...
No, they believed that the two other girls were probably killed. If there's any credible... evidence to this at all, these sightings of her. They do believe the other two girls were deceased at that point, and Rachel is just being held against her will. I don't know. Again, some far-fetched stuff, whether it's credible, I don't know, or rumor. I mentioned Rusty. So he was 11 when Rachel went missing. He remembers, you know, being with the family. Everyone's upset. His sister never came back. His older sister, Deborah, right, who was living with Tommy, Trulissa, and Rachel while they were married. They were married about 6 months when she disappeared. Now, there has been unraveled information over the years. Like I said, this case is almost 50 years old. Things are said. But one thing that he came forward and said to a gentleman who wrote an article on this case, he interviewed Rusty, and Rusty claims that a few people came forward and actually heard an argument between Deborah, Tommy, and Rachel the night before Rachel disappeared. So he believes that his sister Deborah may know more, and he's really not the only one who felt this way in regard to. He says some of the family members went to their deaths, believing that maybe there was something more to this than people were being forward about.
I just don't know how a sister knowing if this guy was involved and it could keep a secret that long.
Being I agree.
A family member.
Yeah, it's hard to keep secrets.
Doesn't mean that he didn't do it. I'm just saying that or responsible or in some form or fashion. But
yeah.
I just couldn't imagine that she would have any sort of knowledge of that and then be able to.
But hold it in all these years, you know.
Yeah, precisely.
They've investigated serial killers who were using Fort Worth to find their victims. There was even one in particular, and he was known as the Mall Passer. This was Mike Bardelibin. Now, Rusty looked into this. He says he even went to this guy's house where he lived, and they went through the attic. There was no sign of Rachel or any of the girls. Now, I talked about the letter. So the day after Rachel and the two girls went to the mall, Rachel's husband, Tommy, and Rachel's older sister, Deborah, okay, they're the ones that show up at the Arnold house. So Rachel's maiden name is Arnold, okay? So they're at Rachel's house, and this is when Deborah shows up with Tommy with letter in hand. So this is, Rusty remembers being 11 years old and passing this letter around. Like, the family's looking at it. The police are already at the family home. They're taking a look at this letter. But I find, they're together. They show up together. They have the letter. And then they say this is where they found it, right? They found it in the mailbox. So we're going to talk about Cotton Arnold, who was Rachel's father. He was also someone that came up, you know, first of all, he died about 6 months after Rachel disappeared. He had stage 4 melanoma, and he was very sick and dying when Rachel disappeared. And 6 months later, he was dead. So rumors came around. Because Deborah and Rachel have always said that they didn't have a good childhood. Their father was very abusive. Some rumor even has it possible sexual abuse could have been going on between him and his daughters. None of that has been, that I have seen, has actually been corroborated. I'm sure some of the PIs uncovered some stuff looking into Cotton. But he's the one who actually owned the body shop that Tommy bought. Tommy had purchased this shop, but it used to be Cotton's. So they had access to cars. They had access to, different automobiles. Like I said, the one Rachel was driving was said to have actually belonged to Tommy and his family. Because I remember I mentioned there were three $50 bonds that he says was in the glove compartment that were not there when they retrieved the car. Whether they were there in the first place, we don't know. But this is something that he has said. I also have read other places that the car Tommy was driving that day has never been recovered. I don't know whether that is actually true, but they were looking for the automobile because he said he was at work all day. But his timeline cannot directly be accounted for. There are gaps. in what I read. But again, it's like we've gone this long. I didn't find any information that Tommy Trulissa was never cooperative with investigators. He answered their questions and he gave them what he want, you know, what they wanted. But 2 years after Rachel's disappearance, he files for divorce. So he files for abandonment is the reason he used, because his wife never came back. And then he ends up marrying shortly after that, okay? And so a lot of this stuff revolves around, you know, is it a coincidence that Tommy's marriages, the couple he has after, are one is from Weatherford, where we talked about the possible zip code coming from, mm-hmm. and the other one is in Throckmorton. You know, little strange, but again, it's like it's this little womp, like ball of confusion, right? And coincidence, and you
know, how far away are those from Fort Worth?
30 to 45 minutes. So, you know, you have all of these, and by the way, a lot of this comes from interviews that Rusty has done. Tommy Trulissa will say that Rusty, you know, has come forward and said these things that aren't even true. You know, Rusty will say that Tommy, you know, there's things about his sister and that Deborah should have taken a lie detector test. So his sister did an interview back in 2000 with the Fort Worth Star-Telegram. And after that interview, the family members came forward and sent a letter to Deborah begging her to go and take a lie detector test. So there were suspicions that after that interview, she basically said she felt like her sister was sold into white slavery. People thought that comment was a little strange.
I don't think that was very popular, but who knows, back then.
But okay, we call it sex trafficking now, right? Or selling people, stealing them, selling them, whatever they're doing. But why are they going to take the time to drop off a letter? It all goes back to this letter for me. They're not going to do that.
Well, and those people would have been very premeditated to know if it's just some random person. I mean, did he sell them?
I mean, who's he? Just whoever?
Tommy? Like you said, they were sold into white slavery. It's like somebody scooped them up and sold them, or he had something to do with that?
Well, I don't know. It came out of her sister's mouth.
I know. I'm just saying, though, like, if you listen, like, who's going to sell them into that? These people that are selling them?
Right.
Like, they're going to give up their address? I mean, I don't know. Maybe so. I mean, I guess that could be the case. You could always kidnap somebody and ask them their address and send them that everything's okay to throw people off. But it just, the letter came too quickly in order for that to occur. So I wouldn't really buy that. The letter was sent well before these girls disappeared, in my opinion.
Right. And so if the stamp is canceled the morning of the 24th, we can assume it was dropped off the 23rd. The 22nd. I mean, here's the thing with the letter. The written letter itself was in pen. This is a big key thing for me. And then the outside of the envelope was pencil.
On the 22nd or 23rd, it would even be sorted at that point to cancel it, much less be put back in a bin to get on a mail truck to go back out and be delivered down the street.
Yeah, and you have
to
wonder.
Things are done by hand at this time frame.
I was thinking about that. Yes, when you said that last time on the episode, I thought about this. And I also think you might be right. This number, like I'm looking at that envelope with that zip code, and I personally think that it was just an accident. I think it's an error. If that is a backwards 3 on that last digit, I don't think that was necessarily purposely done. This is, you know what I'm talking about? You roll those numbers. You know what I mean? And remember, it was like you had to make sure you had it right, and then you had to like go back down. We used to stamp things all the time with these dates on it. In offices, secretaries used to use them. It's not uncommon to go backwards with it. So I kind of think that it was an accident as far as like the bold numbers go and the backwards digit. Do I think it came within the vicinity of Fort Worth? I do. I just can't say where exactly it came from, but yeah, I think it did. And is someone just going to go 30, 45 minutes outside of the outskirts of Fort Worth to mail that letter thinking that's far enough? To me, that's like not far enough. To me, that's like someone who lives somewhere, wants to go away to get out of the zip code, but you're not going to go too far because you still live in that area. So I think this is someone who lives in this area. I think this they need to think about the fact that that letter is written in pen. The envelope is in pencil. So that tells me that was addressed later and they didn't have a pen. Like they had to use what they had, right? And that was addressed when it was ready to send. But I think the letter itself was already in that envelope, ready to go. So, I don't know. It's just, I would like to talk to someone who may have worked in the Postal Service in the 70s and find out, you know, what that looked like in regard to when would that letter have had to be dropped off. And you would have had to know they were going to be in that parking lot. In the Sears parking lot. So how did they get away with planning that?
Yeah. How many people would have known they would have been going to Sears?
Or did she always park there? Like, that's something else I could not find that I was interested to know. Is that, was this a typical parking spot for her when she went to the mall? I don't know. So, again, I mentioned Rusty really just sort of, you know, taking a you know, a front seat to this case. He worked with multiple private investigators along the years. Chris, I actually had a couple of people reach out that are close to this case. And one of them made a comment that, you know, this letter needs to be looked at again. Like, across the board, they all agreed that these private investigators agreed on one thing. That they don't believe Rachel wrote this letter, but they believe it was someone who knew Rachel. And here's something else I want to point out. There's three victims here. But Rachel is sort of the centerpiece in this letter, and they drop it off at her home. So to me, Rachel was the target. The two girls are probably just, who knows? Was Rachel originally supposed to be alone? Was she going to go alone and then decided, you know, Deborah says that she asked her sister to go and she said no because she was tired from the night before. But then she asked these two girls to come with her. And again, that letter says they're going to Houston. That 9-year-old, I think they would have dropped her off. Like if there's any context in this letter and people believe it at all, you know, they wouldn't have taken the 9-year-old.
That's for sure somebody that knew where they were going to be, right? The one that was tired and didn't want to go.
Yes. So did Tommy Trulissa, because she was going to stop for her shop for his son, who was going to be there. But then so did Julianne Mosley's brother, right? Because he's the one dating Renee at this time. And they're having a conversation, and this is how the 9-year-old ends up going with them. So, you know, I don't know. You know, it's hard to say. And if it is true that they were having a fight the night before, why would she ask her sister to go? Like, to me, if it was a big blown out fight, again, there have been multiple witnesses that have come forward about different things, and I'll mention that in a minute. But if this is true, would she even want her sister to go? I don't know. But her sister says she did ask her. After that interview, so I'm going to assume, since this was in 2000 that this interview was done with Deborah over the case, that she may have never originally taken a poly. And here's another thing I couldn't find. I was hoping to get some sort of police report on this, but did Tommy Trulissa take a lie detector test? I don't know if I was just missing it in my information and all the articles I was reading and looking at. But if anybody has any information on that and whether he passed it or not, I don't know. But a big part of also the whole father thing was, you know, was there something that Rachel was now going to expose about her dad, right? Because they said this, that he was kind of an evil guy. And, you know, but then his wife says when Rachel disappeared, it was, you know, she believes he died of a broken heart. You know, he waited by the car for someone to return the girls that night. And she says he's sick, had a fever, like just stood there. You know, I don't know. So all these rumors, again, are they rumors? Are they actually, you know, are they real? Was any of this abuse ever? Now, Rusty has said he has seen his sisters get beat by their father. So that is verified by Rusty. But as far as the sexual abuse goes, and if there was something going on at that time, remember, she's 17 years old. I don't know. The man has stage 4 melanoma, and can barely take care of himself. So it seems a little far-fetched for me to think he's going to be able to overtake 3 girls. Well,
and just because somebody's an asshole doesn't make them a killer. So
that's right. That's right. So, and then again, it's like the whole sex trafficking thing and selling. It all goes back to the letter. And this was like the hope factor. Again, I pointed this out. Like, did Rachel wrote the letter?
They had the one guy in Houston, the Candyman, who was writing those, sending postcards to, you know, kids' families, and you know that they had gone away to work and find a job. I mean, I guess it's possible that somebody would have the foresight to think that may throw people off of a case. Mm-hmm. I don't know.
Well, right, to buy time. He wanted to buy time to bury them, right, and to dispose of them, and he was putting lime on some of them.
I don't know how he got their
them.
Addresses, but I guess he forced it out of them.
Remember, he was local. I mean, he probably, you know.
I know, but I'm
probably,
just saying. Knowing,
but at that time, were you able to look up? I mean, that was like phone book times, right? They have addresses in phone books?
I mean, they did but they? How do you know parents' names that you don't have a kid's name in a phone book? So I don't know. I mean, I'm just saying that somebody could have been smart enough to do that. It doesn't seem likely, though. I still think just the whole randomness doesn't make much sense.
I was watching like some psychologist show, and it actually said that women are more likely to write letters and cut out letters, right? And, you know, when people like cut out the letters and not write it, and they glue it, you know, and then they put it in the mailbox, right? Or they give it to someone, or, you know, they actually said women are more likely to do that than men, which I find interesting. So, again, goes back to, did a woman write this? Did Rachel write this? Did someone who knows Rachel write this? And again, it's the address of Thomas A. Trulissa, right? So she never called him that. So who would have addressed him like that? You know, so again, that's another thing. Were they not thinking about addressing him as Tommy because she addressed him that way? Who would have put his full name? I don't know. This case is just mind-boggling. A few of the witness statements. One came forward and said she observed 3 girls being hustled into a pickup truck by unidentified men the day they vanished. Another witness came forward in 1981 and stated he saw an unidentified male forcing a girl into a van in the mall parking lot. Now, when he says he actually approached them, and the man told him it was a family dispute and asked him to stay out of it. Now, neither of these stories have actually been verified by authorities. But I do find that a little interesting that what if this is true and someone says family dispute and says to stay out of it? It's very interesting.
I agree.
Other witness reports that Rachel and that the girls were seen alive, like in the initial days following their disappearance at a gas station. But they really believe that the 2 girls, you know, they were already deceased, and that Rachel maybe had been being kept alive and visiting Fort Worth with unnamed persons. Again, seems a little far-fetched to after all of these years. But hey, we have seen people disappear for 40-something years and then reappear and be found. So, you know, I don't know if there's any claim to that. Now, this is in 2001. NBC5 in Texas reported that a witness came forward and told Fort Worth investigators that he saw 3 girls getting inside a pickup truck with a young male security guard at the shopping center at approximately 11:30 p.m., Now, he said that the girls were sitting in the truck willingly. It looked like they were not, they were just sitting there, right? As though maybe they had been in trouble, but they were just sitting, he said, in the front seat calmly. He said he contacted authorities a few days following the girls' disappearances, but that investigators failed to follow up with him until 2001. So once they did, they actually found that security guard, and he denied having the girls in this truck on that evening. So nothing ever came to that. So you have these witness statements. There was another witness that went to the clerks that were at the store inside. Now, Chris, people did report seeing them in the mall. One of the girls was wearing a very distinct shirt. I can't remember exactly what it said, like happy day. There was just something very specific about it, and people do remember seeing her. So I think they were in the mall at some point. I think they were in the mall. Were they... You know, did something happen when they left the mall but didn't quite make it back to the car? Was someone roaming that parking lot looking for that car? You know, that's another, like, I don't know. But then we go back to the letter. Like, the letter was already written, in my opinion, before this day. And they knew where the car was going to be. And I have a lot of questions around that, whether this was somewhere she always parked, whether there was a reason that someone specifically told her to go there for something specific. I can't find any of that information out. And really, what was the whole idea of buying him more presents? You know, Tommy Trulissa went to work all day long, according to his, you know, testimony and where he was. And he went to his bowling league. But, you know, I don't know. Like, did he send her to the mall knowing she was going to be at a certain store? Were there other people who had conversations with her? I just would like to know some of this, because I'm with you. I think that letter was written, well, not well before this happened, but within a few days of this happening.
Well, I just think, too, it's the challenge of wrangling three people in the car, to me, would lead me to believe they would be getting in a car with somebody that they know. Versus someone just pulling up and, I don't know, I mean, pulling a gun. I guess they are young people, so they may not know that you know, you're probably better off getting shot running away than facing whatever's in that car for you. But I don't know. I guess you could convince three very young people, two very young people, two, you know, including the 17-year-old, to climb in the car, but I just, that's the logistics of handling all that, especially with just by one individual, seems, I don't know, my opinion, unlikely.
Well, and you also have to think that all three of them would have to have that mindset, right? To just get in the car and not scream or not make a commotion, just be compliant. Yeah, and to me, that's a little strange.
I don't see three young people either being very calm, much less trying to keep a 9-year-old calm. While holding a gun on somebody, forcing them into somewhere.
Yeah. And again, this is Christmas Eve, parking lot, broad daylight.
Yeah, lots of people. That's why.
Lots of people.
That leads me to believe that somebody that knew them, so somebody close enough to where they would get in a car with them and take off.
I mean, there's children, kids were not in school on Christmas Eve. There's kids at the mall. They can be sitting in front seats, right, of their parents' trucks. I mean, this was 1970 something, right? Like, that's what they did. They sat in the, you sat in the front seat of the truck, and there may have been four of you, but you're all four stacked in that front seat of the truck. So I feel like this could have been easily mistaken for other girls that were seen that were not the actual three girls that we're looking for. You know, again, unfortunately, just really none of these witness statements panned out. Once they followed up, there was really nothing to back them up except eyewitness testimony, which is, can be very difficult to prove, right? Especially if only one person sees it. So, you know, I think at this point in 2023, looking at this case, you know, can it ever, do you think this will ever be solved? And if it can be solved, what do you think needs to happen? I personally think it's the letter. They either need to go back to the drawing board and take a look at either more samples. I don't know. Do you force people to turn over more writing samples at this point?
Not fingerprints on the actual letter?
I did not see any. I mean, this is before DNA evidence, right? But there is fingerprinting.
They've been doing fingerprints since the 50s. So
I did not see anywhere that it had fingerprints on it. I don't know what the police report says, right? That's what I mean. Like, we don't know. I assume it was, but... I mean,
not on the outside of the envelope. That's passed through many hands, but the actual contents inside, so...
Yeah, that's another thing. So many people touching it. I think that was one thing that I saw is, how do you know? I mean, I'm sure they may have pulled fingerprints and probably even talked to those people, you know, found them, or if they could, or, you know, put them in the system eventually.
You put out a picture of the letter. It doesn't appear to have any sort of
dusting
indication that they've dusted for prints. I mean, so I don't know. I mean, I'm not saying that. I mean, what do I know about those sorts of things? But
I mean, I would imagine they would have done some testing on it. But again, it's 1970s, so probably just the fingerprint, right?
And but then they still have the letter in their possession.
They do.
And it's,
you know, I
it's
wish
not like it was written in the 1600s, and it's a piece of papyrus, so they could still open it up and do something with it.
Yeah, and again, it's like, this is, to me, it's the only piece of evidence, but. I mean, I'm going to go out and just say that I believe this is somebody that knew them. I think that the other two girls were unfortunately just in the wrong place at the wrong time with Rachel. I think she was the target. I think the letter revolves around her for a reason. And again, I think that letter was written and signed before this even happened, which convinces me even more she was the target. And I don't know if they just didn't know the other two girls were going to be there. I'm kind of like there with that. There were no cell phones. There wasn't any way for really, if somebody's out planning this, they would have, and they weren't anywhere near them when they left for the mall, then they would have, then maybe they weren't expecting all three of them.
I don't understand what,
like, she's the target to me. And now you've got two girls with her. Like, I don't know. Maybe they thought she would go alone.
Well, and also I don't understand the motive. Clearly he's able to divorce somebody and be done with them. I mean, he's married, he's married four times total, right?
So currently married,
I mean, I'm just saying, like, and granted her age, it's not like that's going to be that hard to end that relationship. So I don't know. That's the other part too that makes it pretty challenging, is what was his motive for potentially being involved?
I don't know. Was there something else going on that nobody really knew about? Was something going on behind those closed doors? I mean, we know Deborah and Tommy dated, right?
He manages to marry her older sister and then also another woman. And
no, he didn't marry her older sister. They were engaged, but then, you know what I mean? But then he married Rachel after that relationship. And then she moves in with him.
But then he's remarried after that. And so it just, I don't know what went. He had a failed marriage before, had a failed marriage after that. This marriage was failing. Why did the other two women, pre and post, manage to be alive and still? That's what I mean. Like, what's the advantage to that too for him? Like, other than, I don't want to be with you anymore. Let's get a divorce.
I don't know.
So I think that's probably too what the cops are struggling with, is what would be his motive in it.
I'm with you. I don't know.
What sort of information could she possibly?
Well, because it's not like Tommy and Deborah became like we're together after this. I mean, that's where I struggle. It's like, if there was something going on, did nobody else know about it? I mean, did just something, was this a heat of a moment thing? Did somebody go to the mall to meet her to talk about something? And then it just went wrong? Like, that's where I'm just, I mean, why not let them go? like, why kill? And because we're going to, I'm going to assume they're all deceased. Okay. We're just going to say that. How, but why did something happen in front of them to where you can't, like, they witness something, right? And then you have to eliminate the witnesses. Like, see, that's where I struggle, is why kill both of them? And I always think stranger on stranger. Yes, I can. No relation, no love lost between victim, right, and perpetrator. But this, I don't. But the, I go back to the letter, and I don't think this is a stranger abduction. I think this is someone who knew them, and this was planned. And I don't know why, but because her name is in that letter, and because of where this letter ended up, I think she was the target. And, you know, it's just, it's baffling.
I agree.
Totally baffling. Tips have come in over the years. They've pulled cars out of lakes. They thought at one point the girls' bodies were in the back of a trunk, in a car. They recovered bones that they thought for sure belonged to the missing girls, but none of it. There's been clothing found. I talked about the undergarments that were found, not just a couple of weeks after they disappeared. But there's nothing. I mean, nothing at even point in a direction to where they went, what happened to them. All the leads point back to the shopping center, to the parking lot where the car was found, and to this letter.